mean, we're really glad to have the panel that we have today. The A&D market over the past 30 to 40 years has had many changes in structure, companies, and business models. Sales today is much more complex and involves a number of factors beyond price, quality, and on-time delivery. However, despite the very dynamic nature of the market, there are some simple lessons and basics that are always there. This morning, a panel of three highly experienced sales and marketing VPs will share some of the basic lessons and ideas that they have learned along the way in decades-long careers working on both large and not-so-large A&D companies. David Conrad is the Vice President, Sales, Marketing, and Customer Service at Zodiac Waste and Water Aerosystems in Carson. Has over 30 years of experience in aviation and aerospace with particular things in business marketing, business development, strategic planning, supply chain development, repair capabilities development, customer support, and process improvement. With an abundance of international experience, David has a strong understanding of the aviation and aerospace markets in Asia, North America, Europe, and the Middle East. Prior to joining Zodiac, David spent 3 years as the Director, International Sales and Marketing of?
Gamaco.
An MRO based in China. David was also served as Vice President of Sales, Marketing, and Customer Service, as well as General Manager, PSI, at Rexnord Aerospace. He has held the position of Senior Director, Business Development, China Region for Goodrich Cargo Systems, also based in Beijing, China. Prior to that, he was Vice President, Marketing Customer Service at Aero Union Corp, and earlier had progressed through a number of business development and leadership positions in Honeywell Allied Signal, a company that's had a long standing within the South Bay. Next, we have Jason Childs, who's the Vice President of Worldwide Sales and Marketing for Esterline Engineered Materials. He has successfully conducted business on the ground in 30 countries, and in 2009 was presented with a Certificate of Export Achievement by the U.S. Department of Commerce. He was further honored by the U.S. Secretary of Commerce with an appointment to the U.S. Regional District Export Council. Mr. Childs currently serves on that council and plays an active role in increasing U.S. exports. Jason is a longtime supporter of the Special Olympics, the United Way, and the NFL Players Association. Next, we have John Jakarian. He's a VP of Business Development with Aerospace Engineering Corp. in Southern California, with a 40-year career in aerospace. Growing up in Lancaster, California during the 60s, John was introduced to aerospace early while spending time flying with his father, who was a private instructor, and occasionally going to Edwards Air Force Base, where his father worked. During his career, John has worked in quality, engineering, contracts, project management, sales, and leadership roles. His earliest projects included the Space Shuttle External Tank and the F-117 Stealth Fighter. John has extensive experience in chemical milling, metal forming, machining, and fabrication within the aerospace sectors. Please join me in welcoming David Conrad, Jason Childs, and John Jakarian. We're going to start off our panel with Jason. Before we launch into that, our panelists come from all different sectors of aerospace. They're just all different aspects of it, and I wonder if, Jason, you can touch on the types of products within aerospace that you represent at Esterline.
Sure.
So Esterline is a roughly $2 billion corporation. Engineered Materials is a division of that company, and we primarily work through six individual companies. TA Aerospace, which makes metallic clamps, some fire barriers, primarily involved in preventing as well as the wire, things like that. PNC, Molding Corporation, Wire Management. So really looking at if you're inside an aircraft, a commercial aircraft, you would see all the tubes and wires that run along. Those are retained by non-metallic clamps, typically manufactured by NMC. Dark air engineering, we make nacelle and strut insulation, so metallic, highly flame resistant, really high temperature insulation materials. Kirkhill, which makes elastomeric rubber seals, grommets, ducts, and TA, high-tech. High-tech in Washington does a lot of thermal spray, special chroming, specialty paints, those types of things. So those are the business units that I'm responsible for the sales of.
Yes, the scary thing is I financed machinery for Kirkhill in the 80s when they were privately owned, so it's amazing. Yeah. So, Jason, can you tell us what are the major factors contributing to Esterline's sales success over the past few years?
So, that's a good question. I would say we've been pretty fortunate. We've had 3 years of record growth at the platform, so sales success has been pretty significant. We won't probably match that that pace this year, but we'll still have some growth. And I would attribute that primarily to a focused strategy. So in 2013, we decided to lay out a strategy that was a bit more focused on non-U.S. We had predominantly sold to Boeing and its sub-tiers and looked at the market and said, okay, well, how are we going to grow in those areas? And realized, why shouldn't we grow with Airbus and its subsidiary companies, its suppliers? So we spent a lot of time developing those relationships. They have a big presence
Airbus here in the United States.
They have a lot of contacts.
They were trying to dollarize
some spend, so we took advantage of that. They have done quite well in Europe. And in that process, I think we looked at what other things could we do, and part of that was, do we need to upgrade our sales force? So there was quite a bit of attention spent on that, finding the right team members. And that can be challenging. As you said, Kirkhill had been around in the 80s, was coming up actually quite a bit longer than that, and had some legacy sales folks that were not performing as well as you would like. We worked with some of those guys, had some formalized training, sent them off to some 1 or 2 week courses at different universities, and then raised the bar on weekly meetings and reviewing those types of things. And to be honest, saw some pretty good turnaround from guys that people want to be successful, right? They want to find a way to win. We gave them some more tools, and we saw a lot of those guys really do well, and they're continuing to do well for us. Unfortunately, some of the folks didn't make it, and I have a relatively large sales team, so you're talking probably 30 direct sales guys. It was a very small percentage of them that didn't make it, and I think training and regular communication,
regular status on the strategy, and kind of an interactive approach.
So I was taking a lot of advice or comments from the team. We had a little bit of what I call constructive conflict. So you can have a meeting, you can disagree, and in some cases fairly vigorously. But we kept it from being a personal issue and really got into, okay, how are we going to solve a problem? And once we solved some of those, our groups came up with a strategy. We let that be the strategy, and then no one was allowed to kind of argue it after that.
So I think those are some of the keys to success for us. I do think that
successful
sales is somewhat of a... it's almost like a cold, right? You catch it. And once you've had a bit of success, you get a little more,
and it becomes a routine, and it becomes a habit. And if you recognize people
for their successes, they tend to,
I'm driven
that way, and I know most of my team is, you get some success, somebody recognizes you for it, you want to get it again, and you keep doing that, and that
goes on itself. Until you've got a team full of people that really want to to take it to the next level and the next. And you know, here we are 5 years later, and everybody is now operating at a much higher level. Because they've seen some success and translate that into, okay, today was a good day. And we really break it down into kind of days, weeks, months, years.
If you looked at
going to sell to Airbus and said, wow, what's the strategy for that tomorrow? You can kind of say, wow, that's a big task. But if you say, okay, 3 years from now, I want to be successfully selling to Airbus. What do I need to get there? And you start to map that backwards and say, okay, by year two, I need to be doing X. By year one, I need to be doing this.
6 months away.
And then you can say, all right, now that's a manageable step. I can do, you know, the 6 month plan. And once you get there, you say, all right, we're good, or maybe we're behind, maybe we're ahead of schedule, and you work on your next kind of 6 month piece. And I'm very open to
questions after this. I've got to move kind of on time,
but everyone will have my contact information. If you want to talk about it, I'm more than willing to talk in addition to this meeting, so don't hesitate to reach out to me.
Very good. Well, I'm glad you brought up momentum, because that's always very important. David, before we launch into you, is there anything you want to expand on what you get involved in at your company?
No, the company I'm at today is really, it's very simple. We provide the water and the waste systems. I mean, I'm joking when you say I'm the best damn toilet. That's just the, kind of, as we say, the tip of the iceberg, because a lot of my equipment you never see. It's below the deck of the airplane. But it's we are a world leader in the technology. Have been for a number of years. It's getting more competitive. More people want into that market space. Amazingly, there is a lot of money to be made in waste. No, I think that's kind of the only punchline there.
Okay. What do you see as the keys to success that you have found in your career in sales and marketing in the A&D markets?
You know, I gave that whole question a lot of thought, and it really distilled down to when I was fortunate enough to leave military service and join the aerospace aviation community a few years ago. I had somebody who mentored me from the very beginning.
He had some basics, but
kind of sales and marketing is hard work. And, you know, today we have all this wonderful technology we try to lean on, which, you know, computers, emails, smartphones, social media, all of this. We forget that there's a person on the other end of the transaction in sales and marketing. And seeing them, talking to them, listening to them is critical to do. You know, it's nice to keep in touch with email in between, but sometimes you just have to go and sit across the table from the person and ask the question. And, you know, as a salesperson, you have this driving tendency.
You want to keep sounding without, you've got to stop that. It's okay to make your pitch, but then you need to stop and listen to what the other person has to say about it. Part of this, too, is that your image in the marketplace is important. For people who've been in the aviation industry, Aviation Week, when they can't sell the back page, bad. They used to run this wonderful Norman Rockwell picture. It was a very curmudgeonly purchasing guy. He took signs of purchasing. This guy's like very grumpy. And he looks at it and goes, I don't know you. I don't know your company. I don't know your product. I don't know what you stand for. Now, what is it you want to sell me? So if you don't have, if you can't create that image, so that you get past those questions, you'll never get to, now what do you want to sell me? Because they don't know who you are. And again, it goes back to sitting down face to face, understanding them, listening to them. It's also that personal touch. I probably know more birthdays, anniversaries, wives, children of my customers than the average, because I pay attention to that. What makes this person passionate? Is it golfing on the weekend?
Know what makes them passionate. Listening to them gets you that. And it gives you that chance to make a personal connection. You know, many times we go out and we take people out to dinner. You know, it's part of what we do on entertainment. We sometimes forget there's a spouse or significant other that's still sitting at home. Take them out too. It's all about connecting to the customer that makes you successful. Because if the customer feels connected to you, they're going to share with you. They're going to tell you, hey, good offer, but you know, you need to sharpen it up a little bit more. And now that I've raised the ugly issue of price, let me just say, there are basics in the market. You got to have AS9100. You got to have the right design. You got to have the qualifications. You got to have the right price. That gets you in the game. That doesn't win your business. What wins your business is how you act and what you do when things go horribly wrong. As they will. Murphy is an aerospace engineer. And it's that support, that service, that reaction to what you did that gets them to pay attention to you more than brand X. And listen to what you have to say more than brand X. They trust you. Again, it's all about connection, trust, and listening.
Very good. Next, I wanted to turn to John Shakirian. John's with an aerospace manufacturing company. And John, could you just, before we launch into you, can you share with what type of parts that is the expertise of aerospace engineering?
Absolutely. We specialize in complex structures, ground support equipment. One example would be that we recently put together a articulating battery launch loader for NASA program. Their tolerances on that were tighter than some aerospace tolerances for passenger jets because they don't want to take a 500-pound battery and bang it into the satellite that they're loading up. We do a lot of machining. We do a lot of design and engineering, but the design and engineering is the selling point for us. If we compete head-to-head with a machine shop, any machine shop in the area, we're not going to get their attention. Much to what was being said here is that it's the personal touch and that thing that you do differently than your competition, the one thing that makes the difference to get somebody to actually listen to you. And we have that in our design and fabrication often.
Very good. Well, John, having worked in both large and small aerospace companies, what, if any, changes in the marketplace and the marketing or sales approach will be required for success in the future?
Well, thank you for the question. I'm going to back up a little bit. I introduced us all, and obviously we're all old because of all the generations. And thank you for that. I'm actually only 29. These are aerospace years. I started out, my first taste of sales was with a company called AeroChem, and they were in Orange, and they did chemical milling. And chemical milling is an interesting, nasty process that the role for that particular point in my life in the sales thing was not, you know, hey, I need your chemical milling work. People didn't know what it was. So that role actually became more technical, more sell the process. And in that case, the success was to convince somebody that, yeah, you've been machining that in that regard, but now I can take a vat of nasty fluid and get you not only the part you want, but a lot of them at a lot of time. Go into that and tell anybody that's interested afterwards. That was a different role. That was more of a technical sell process, not sell machining, which everybody that's looking for machining pretty much understands. The next step in that was I was recruited to go into Duke Commons machining, stretch forming capabilities that they do with that. And at that time, the selling point was the size of the parts that could be stretched from them and then generated because they have that company now. And that's what kept it
and the times we're doing special government on that level, on that size. Our current situation is a little different. As I said, we're a machine shop, and that by itself makes it not unique. But we do have a lot of machine capability, but when I go through the door and I talk to somebody, I'm telling them that I can help you design that part better. We can do it on blueprint, but we can do this, we can do it from scratch. The feather in the cap for Aerospace Engineering Corp is that we can actually get involved at the design stage and make some improvements perhaps. So we're comfortable in that role, and that's the part.
Very good. David, I wonder if you could tell us, with the changing dynamics of the aerospace and defense markets over the past few years, how has that changed sales and marketing?
The question is really interesting given some of the audience here, because, over the last, 10, 15 years, what we've seen is a complete change in the way the industry has been structured. Driven a lot by finance, availability of money, private equity, all of this in the market. As a result, what we've seen is a consolidation in the industry. We've gone from many customers down to just a few core customers. So that changes the customer base. At the same time, what we're seeing is kind of changes in the customers. As it used to be back in the good old days, I would go in there and I would convince them that we had the greatest technical product ever. That was it. I was on the airplane. Today, it's much more commercial. The engineers get their little check in the block. Yep, we can accept it. And that becomes more important in commercial terms. And even to the point where those of us in the industry hear those wonderful phrases such as partnering for success. Or, on the other side of the equation, Route 06 and Scope Plus. They all mean the same thing. Lower prices. The other thing that has become a big driver in the industry that changes the scope is differentiation. A 777 sold to United Airlines is the same as a 777 sold to Singapore Airlines. It's the same airplane. What changes? It's what you put inside the big city too.
If it's innovative, if it's new,
if it delivers value.
And value is cost, weight, passenger experience.
You can sell. If it's same old, you're going to have a challenge. Now, along with this, the customers are expecting more. That's that value, that price, that cost, and that time. Now, I'm going to tell a story sort of on this, on the curve before I got it. But it shows you the thought process that goes into innovation. We've been selling toilets, and I do mean toilets, to Boeing and Airbus for years. We had a competitor who said, I don't like the rules. For me to just go head-to-head, I'm going to lose, because these guys have 50 years of experience. They have a proven product. How can I develop? So their thinking process was, if you don't like the competitive environment, change the environment, change the playing field. So instead of selling a toilet against my toilet, they sold a laboratory, the whole house, with all the products in it. So now, instead of a customer buying a toilet and buying a faucet and buying a water heater and buying a laboratory structure and all of that, this guy delivers it all fully integrated. Right? What OEM has to do is plug it in and we're done. It cut costs. It changed the competitive dynamics. And that's the thinking process you have to have. You also want to look at doing things different to allow you to get more value. I spent a few years in the cargo business, air cargo business. One of the things that I learned is that if you maintain your system, certain elements of your cargo system, your maintenance costs overall drop rapidly. And they're very small little items, cargo rollers and bulk transfer units. These are cheap items. If you buy a cargo roller from an OEM, you pay $21 a piece. There are hundreds of them on the airplane, but it's a cheap product. The problem is, when you order it from an OEM,
You have to wait 6 weeks to get it. Well, if it's broken, you're operating 6 weeks. So the rest of your system is absorbing it. We bought a small cargo roller business. And we went out and we listened to the customer, going back to my first answer. We listened. And we understood that if he could change those rollers out, as soon as it failed, he would release his overall maintenance. So we figured out how to Kanban and create a Kanban system so that if you ordered by 9 a.m. up to 1,000 rollers, I would ship them by 5 that afternoon. Hold on. See, the deal you got for that set. Oh, yes, by the way, I sold it for $28 a piece instead of $20. So I just added 33% to my margins by thinking smarter and differentiating myself. That's what you have to do in this changing market environment we're facing. Think how you can be different and how it brings value to your customer.
Jason, you touched on where things have gone with your company. I wonder if you could tell us what innovation strategies you have planned to ensure sales growth for 2016 and beyond.
Sure. So we actually have a very formal process for what we call technology roadmap. And that's a system that was developed by Cambridge University many, many years ago. It's a formal sit-down meeting with a customer. We start to talk about what their needs are. And it goes a bit back to David's comments, connection, trust, listening. If you develop those relationships,
you can go into a customer and say, you know, what are your concerns over the next 3, 5, and 10 years?
You then build those into the Cambridge model, which is really a map that says over 3, 5, and 10 years, what are customer needs? You start to aggregate those after you talk to all of your customers
and say, okay, we've got 2, 3, 4, 5 of those
that we think are the big hitters that are common
across the industry. And then you say,
okay, with that,
what products might we be able to develop with our
current skill set? Not our current capabilities, but what people do we have in place that can help us create products
to meet those needs. Once you've narrowed that down, then you say, okay, what additional resources might we need? Would we have to add an engineer? Would we need some equipment? Would we need some research time? And you start to budget for that and build out your map. So over the kind of 10-year time frame, again, you've got a map that says you need to be in 2 or 3 years, 5 years, 10 years. And then you try and communicate consistently with your customer base to make sure that those needs are still relevant, that someone hasn't already solved that problem with, you know, a disruptive technology or something new, and make sure you're on track. We tend to try and get some of our top customers to be involved with us as we
experiment on products. Okay, try this,
test this one, give us feedback. How does this fit into what you're doing? And it's worked quite well. And I would say, you know, we have a bit of probably a bit more leeway because we're a multi-billion dollar corporation, but I have worked in small businesses and it works just as well there. You might just have one guy working on it, mapping out the process, saying where are we going to go, how are we going to create new products. And particularly in the small business, you create a good new product and you can get out and sell that and you can really amplify your sales success and then the company success. Because typically if you're, you know, small, mid-sized business and you're the one who launches one of those nice products, you know, I mean, you can grow your company at 30, 50, you know, 100% in many cases. And that's pretty neat stuff to do. So I know that CMTC has a lot of resources here, and when I worked at Seiko Systems, we participated in some of that. Again, at Esterline, you start to see what consulting or informational services are available to you.
Not a friend for Iron, but another, you know, consultant. Oftentimes, if you're in a small to medium-sized business, you want to reach out to somebody that has that skill set and can help walk you through
the process. And I've always thought those investments are wise. Right? It's money well spent to go find somebody that knows how to succeed,
has done it before, and get that counseling.
You're not going to
have them do it for you, but they are going to help you understand
Okay. What are the kind of pros and cons of this strategy? What pitfalls might you face? And you realize pretty quickly
there are some things, at least for me, that I didn't know. I'll go down this path and be just fine. And someone will say, your company X tried that 10 years ago.
And it failed miserably. I wonder why. And you start to do some research, and you can pretty quickly keep yourself out of trouble for what I consider to be a reasonable investment. And again, Esterline, we have a ton of resources. We've got a lot of people and can reach out across the boundaries of different companies. But when I was with the smaller corporation or businesses, I really thought it was good to reach out to guys like CMTC and Ivan and others in the industry to get that kind of a sanity check. But
if you're looking for the technology
road mapping process, you can find it pretty quickly. If you just run technology road mapping, Cambridge University, Google search, it'll come up with a map. You can customize it yourself. It's just something to think about, share with your individuals in your business. And if you keep up with that on a kind of monthly basis, talking to your engineering and R&D groups, I think you'll see some pretty good results.
Very good. Any ideas?
If you pull any kind of software, hurting all those cats that you have that are out there doing sales work, you do it just through discussions, or do you do it like Salesforce software, or how do you keep track of your...
So it's a good question. It's a kind of quandary that we're in now. We do not have
software system. I need Salesforce as an example. Then we do others. We're considering it. And software is a big kind of problem, especially for some of the more traditional sales people that I don't know.
Doing it a certain way. But at the same time, you know, our CEO wants a ton of information.
So I find us,
you know, boiling down reports and trying to get him the stuff he wants, and I think software.
But my personal position is that software isn't
the answer for my business. A lot of times people will rely on, if I just put all the data in there, I'll do this. And I think you have to remember, relationships key, getting to know your customers.
And I like to trust my own
team, trust my sales guys. Some of our own kind of in-house stuff to keep us on track. Eventually, I think we're going to go to something like Salesforce.
I'm trying to push the corporation
to do it at a corporate level and not at my business kind of division, because I think it's a better expense for corporate, and if the whole of Esterline is doing it, it makes sense. If my division is doing it, I'm not sure we're going to maximize the benefit.
Well, I have some experience with that, and like anything else, the data that goes in there and the disciplines that keep it up are real important. You can, the theory of it seems to be real good, but the discipline has to be there or you lose out.
Yep, for sure.
I really would also like that. I think the technology road mapping is a critical piece to be able to drive your business where you want to go.
But the one thing that I would add to that is just saying that it's just like when you're sitting down with a customer and he's talking to you, giving them active listening back.
Mm-hmm. The same thing happens with this roadmap. Once you figure it out, this is where you're going to go. You need to go back to those customers. You're going, am I on the track to give you what you need out there in the future? And as long as the answer is yes,
you know you're doing well. Again, it's also part of that responding and active listening with the customer.
Something that Dave obviously touched on was the relationship base. I would have never thought, starting out in this industry, that I would have what I call friends and acquaintances that I've known for 40 years. Somebody that comes into the business at 20 years old, and they're not thinking that this is going to, sometimes they're not thinking it's going to be their business. Aerospace has been a great industry for me. And those people that I touched in my very beginning of my career are still out there. Some of ours, how old they are. But they're on a level now that goes beyond a buyer-seller relationship. And they touch on it just wonderfully. It's really about sitting across the table. The technology is fine. It helps you organize. nothing beats having a relationship. And not everybody's cut out to do that well. I was giving that some thought. I'm not eating too much here. I'll be quick. But there are people that are really good at the technical stuff. The engineers. There are people that are really educated in how sales should work. But the missing element there is the humanity that comes into play that brings those elements together. Like Will Rogers versus Al Blackstone. Now, here you got two different personalities, somebody that can relate to another human being, and you got a guy that can only relate to aliens. Maybe one. But something has to bring that all together to be effective, to be desirable to the people that you're sitting across from. I love this one line that comes out of Pulp Fiction, and it's the scene where Uma Thurman is sitting across from John Travolta at that restaurant that they're at, if you recall that. And she asked an interesting question, and ever since I saw that, I've been asking myself to make sure I have the right answer. She asked if he was a person that was listening or waiting to speak. Is that a great line? For a salesperson, there should be one answer. And beyond the pitch, as you say, right? You need to be listening. These are people that will tell you what you need to know. They want to solve their problem. But if you're waiting to speak, you're going to miss it. And I've deviated, and I apologize for that. But
it was on my mind.
Very good. Well, Jason, I'm glad you brought up the part about getting a third party to kind of get involved sometimes, because I think often we find people are kind of in the middle of their forest. They just don't see things beyond that. And so you termed it as a sanity check, and that's why within banking, within our loan docs, we have a sanity clause.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I'm sorry. There's no such thing as a sanity clause.
Yeah.
Sorry. But anyway, John, one other thing I wanted to turn to you. From your perspective of a smaller shop, how can a small shop expand their customer base? How can they break through the front door? Open meaningful discussions for the first time? Do they get involved in charity events, industry forums? In particular, do you engage in the small business opportunities available through the SBL offices of your customers? How do you go about doing that?
Oh, okay, good question. Well, there's always rejection. You can bang on doors, and there's people that are not interested. Perhaps lazy. I mean, if the buyer's got a company that he's comfortable doing business with and beats you to the punch and he's friends and he knows the birthdays and the anniversary and all that stuff, that makes it a harder access to it. There has to be a lot of persistence, but there has to be a buffer to becoming the Herb Tarlick of your industry. Cal Worthington versus Ralph Williams scenario. Cal Worthington is a real funny guy. You get their attention right away. Ralph was a little bit more of the Herb Tarlick, in your face, I got this by my car kind of thing. There are a lot of small business opportunities through the small business liaisons at the bigger companies. I'll touch on that in particular because I'm getting more into that in this world that I'm in now, and they're wonderful. They are sometimes not focused, that you get into a pool of jobs that are available on the website once you sign up and you are visible in their system. There were things in there from coffee mugs with logos on them to building a nuclear facility, and software opportunities. There were fabrication opportunities that relate to us, but the liaison officers, and I'll tell you one, Marshall Space Flight Center in particular, down in Huntsville, they have a great program. I very much encourage anybody that is interested in just about anything, not just aerospace, but anything from construction to janitorial services. And
They have contacts, they have descriptions, they have budgetary information, past people that were involved in those programs. If I were going to tell one thing that a small business can do is get involved in those programs, and most large companies have those. Others are BAE. I think Lockheed has a liaison as well in the Fort Worth area. I'm not so sure about the Denver group. But it's very much an advantage to be smaller in that regard.
You have to be agile.
You have to be able to respond to customers' needs. Not to pull away from the big guys, but you should have the opportunity, being smaller, to actually save somebody's butt in some fashion if they need something in a hurry. Agility is your best weapon. The other is access. Typically, you will have the customer will have access to the higher levels of a smaller business, the president, the CEO. It's hard to go to Boeing and say, I want to talk to the top guy. I need to know him.
But that was an advantage as well, is that they feel there's a more personal touch, more buy-in at the highest levels of these companies that are smaller.
Take advantage of that. Anybody wants to talk about the small business liaison set up afterwards, I'm sure we can chat a little bit about that.
Chris, I want to just speak about that, and that is one of the people who have done. We do have people still selling the AED a little bit, but people probably have multiple chapters.
So there's like Lockheed and Dell. We need to go fly to Dallas, attend the DFW meeting, and one of the people there is very well into the hockey. So there's that's one of the points of the forum, is if you've got a targeted company, there's two ways to get at it. One is to attend the chapter meeting in that area. Another thing is you call me and say, you've got something just did that. You know, I'd like an introduction to this company. Do you know anybody? Right. And what I've done is, I'll call that person and say, look, John blah, 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 wants to meet with you, and here's why. Is it okay if I connect you? And almost all the time they say, of course, or I'm not the right person, here's the right person. And we connect them. That's part of the thing with the form does. So you ought to know about that and take advantage of it. That's the whole point of small companies.
And that's real important, too. I'm glad you brought that up, because you're typically being asked to sign up, send in your sheet on what you do, your contacts and all that. But you just become, instead of not being in the pond, you're another fish in a large pond. And that's where Ivan's help can come in and break through that. Otherwise, you're knocking on the door of the same liaison guy or gal and saying, hey, please, let me, I've been on this list for 2 months, haven't heard anything. That's
I know Al and I have had discussions on this next question, but how should a small shop go about adding on a business development person where they haven't had one to date, or what advice would you have to anyone new to aerospace and sales and marketing?
Well, that's a great question, and especially at a small business level, typically a homegrown salesperson is the best. They know your business. You observe them in whatever role they had before, whether it be quality, production, whatever role they have. You can assess better than looking at a resume, I think, that this person is potential. It's preferable that way. In how you conduct your interview,
I would be very much interested in knowing how this person relates to other human beings. I'd be less concerned at a small business level, less concerned about his background in school, his attributes that don't have the personal values at that point. But you almost know right away if somebody has got what it takes, if they're giving you standard answers. I'm typically very loose with my conversations as far as talking to people. I look for that in a person that would take on that role. They've got to relate.
back to what Dave said. These relationships are going to be very important for a generation or two in some cases, and the person that is speaking for your company has to be, you have to be proud of them. I mean, you touched on it, you've got to trust them. And when you bring in somebody fresh, there's always this doubt. But if you've worked with this guy before, maybe he's got no aspirations to be in sales. You know, you may not know it. I came out of a quality background. I didn't know I was going to be in sales. So I did have to cut my hair, so that didn't happen. They cleaned me up, and then they shoved me out there, and that kind of thing. But somebody saw something. Somebody saw something. And that's the role of leadership in the sales department, is to be not only a customer, but who your people are. And managing those people is a challenge, but it's gratifying, especially if you share the success and share the mentoring. The mentoring board was easy. Yeah, I was very lucky. They had a very good mentor at the beginning. And I would hope that I am in that as well. I question that all the time to make sure I'm on the right page of it. That I'm listening, I'm waiting to speak.
I'd like to comment on that just a little bit. I would agree with the mentoring piece is good and finding the internal sales guys. I think sometimes you can find the really unusual spots. And all the simple systems, they're run down and shipping. It's just a lot of energy. It's always talking to people, it's always motivated. Work a little extra to do just, you know, something for the customer like that. This guy's got some talent. So convince him to take some community college courses, got him into inside sales, and then groomed him when I was kind of satisfied. I think they had enough basic skills. We gave him a very small territory and let him go out and do it. And he turned out to be a very, very good salesman. But he's literally shipping that. But he wanted to do more, he didn't know what to do. Hadn't had one in the past, like a mentor and
Like I said, the college classes were free or extremely inexpensive.
Sounds like this, a great place to find you. We all know a lot of people, and we know people who know people. When you start to look at your network, somebody's going to be able to speak for this person or give a reference. So if you're going outside, I would say always, you know, kind of reach out to people that you know and just, hey, somebody looking for this kind of a job, you tend to get better
resumes.
And after the night, you can find. And you have to do the job first and find other stuff, but I really think you can reach out to the network and then get somebody that will say, well, then you guys know.
John's got something good to say about him, and I know
John, and then thinking, okay,
that probably works.
The slam dunk is that if you can say, guy out of jail that was the manager of a rock band.
He has all the attributes.
Logistics, personality, dealing with promoters, dealing with budget companies, that guy is going to be a great salesman. You got to go stay.
And even then, doesn't always work.
Yeah. So, David, I wanted to run something by you. As a sales leader in the A&D markets, what do you see as your most important responsibilities?
You know, this is one that has given me, it's kept me up at night trying to figure this one out, because, you know, you as you go through your career, you have great success as a salesperson. And then all of a sudden, one day, somebody taps you on the shoulder and says, guess what? You're now managing these salespeople. It's not an easy thing. And you're not prepared for it. And I'll guarantee you, you'll goof it up. I guarantee it. I'll put it in writing. You're going to goof it up. It takes a while to learn. And it's funny because... you sometimes get so good, it's so focused on being successful, and then when you get to be a manager, you want to be successful again, and you think you need to do it all. And it's a very simple key. You don't need to be. Your people need to be. That's it. Simple, straight, to the point. If they're successful, what are you going to worry about? So you need to set the expectations for them. Tell them what's expected, what they have to deliver. You have to give them the tool, the learning, the opportunity. We talked about getting education for somebody. Getting them training. Giving them that opportunity to succeed. But realistically, it's a mentoring, it's a coaching. I mean, I was very blessed 30 years ago, plus you. I had somebody who literally took me under my wing and said, come with me, young man.
This is what we're going to do. They showed you. And then kind of pushed me out my own boat.
He said,
go ahead.
And pretty soon, it was, go ahead. I'm going to stay back in the office. And I was flying them out. But it's all about that coaching, that mentoring, making sure we can be successful.
It's also a really tricky limited way, too.
We're all human beings. We all have our human frailties. And when something happens, it's always good. Yes, I get it. It's the wrong answer as a leader. They did it. Period. If something goes wrong, I did it. You take the hit as a leader. You know, I had the pleasure of spending 4 years in the service of my country as a U.S. Army officer. And there are only two things that stuck through all of my training as an Army officer, other than the technical stuff that didn't count. One, and the most important, as a leader, you're responsible for everything your people do and everything they do not do. That's all about setting the expectations for your people and holding them accountable. But when stuff happens, they get the credit. That's your responsibility.
The second. If you want to create change, you have to provide a significant emotional experience.
I know where you know David Massey.
No, if you look at it, we had T-shirts printed off. This significant emotional was signal because I was in the signal corps.
Okay.
Don't ask.
That's why it's stuck.
But it was.
But it's true.
That's also part of it, is creating change. It's a significant emotional experience. It goes back to what Jason was talking about.
When I saw a
chairman of Dr. Phil Macy, I think it was a Ohio State, I'm not sure if now it's what he is. But he basically said that your gun leather value system is formed when you're 10 years old. Whatever you were experiencing then will be who you become, short of a significant emotional experience taking place. And this comes into play with sales, because you will be dealing with people that were born in the 50s, grew up in the 60s, and then keep moving that scale over, and that's who they're dealing with. They learned their value somewhere at 10 years old in the 50s. What was going on? Is it a bad thing to know that in sales? No, it's not. Leads into becoming a student of aviation in particular. You know, for my line of work, know what was happening throughout aviation. There's some significant milestones, and some of the people we're talking to might have been involved with that and have a real passionate connection to it in the past. The significant emotional experience that the doctor was talking about in this case was that you're going to be a jerk if you were a jerk 10 years old and your dad teaching your teachers taking you and all that stuff. You're going to be a jerk because that's where you're going to go. But if you have significant emotional experience, marry the right person, suffer a loss that brings you back into a core of understanding of life in general, then you will have a chance to break through that mold. But going to the sales thing, knowing what your customers are going to and their life experiences can't hurt you knowing that. It gets back to that personal touch of how are you going to know that? Quickly, I'll get out of the way of this, but I knew a person I was trying to break into a small business group. Through my connections, I knew that she was an Army officer, and she was stationed in San Diego. But I knew that, and that became a topic, and kept her on the phone, where it was usually going to be the small business people, give you what you need to know, and then off you go. Well, learned a lot about her. Scoop guys. Went to Hawaii. Husband was in Hawaii. I know all that stuff now. And there's a reason for me to call her and follow up, and she'll remember that connection. Not because I'm anything special, but just because I know what she has going on.
I have one final question. Part of sales is overcoming obstacles. And I'm gonna start with Jason, and we'll go down the line. What are the major obstacles that you see in the industry for 2016?
Okay. And I'll try and keep this brief. I'm going to leave some time for open questions. But the obstacles for us, I think, in 16,
at least in our business, are the fact that there are not a lot of new programs launching now, right? So you got your single-aisle stuff, and people have been leaning and focused on that.
But the next big platform
isn't really out there. So there might be
Modification of the A380. There is likely to be, there is going to be the long-range bomber. But if I look at commercial aerospace, what's next? And a lot of the 777X stuff is already decided. So you really have to be aware that we've come out of a pretty good cycle of new launches. A lot of that stuff's been awarded, and you're going to have to go to war and try and win something that you're not on, or figure out a way to improve product and go in with a generational improvement. So I really view that as an obstacle. I also think here in California, we've got we and our business in particular, hiring has been tough to find really good qualified people, operators, engineers, salespeople, almost in every category. You hear about unemployment, but we don't typically see the great candidates coming in that I think we did 4 or 5 years ago. So that's a challenge for us.
In Texas.
Yeah. I think a lot of businesses have moved to areas that are more business friendly. We have facilities in Mexico. We have facilities all over the United States, and very few of them are faced with the kind of hiring challenges that we have in California. Just tough. So that's where I'm at.
think from my perspective, we see two strategic, I call them strategic challenges. Number one is, where am I going to find growth? Jason is right. The number of OEM programs that are coming, I can count on one hand, have a few fingers left. So, how do I find growth in that kind of a market? It's a challenge. The second obstacle or challenge that we see is, call it execution/cost. I have customers who are expecting cost reductions year over year. I have senior management who expects more money every year. So how do I get my cost down so I can satisfy two diametrically opposing forces?
Well, from my perspective, we have a handful of competitors that do what we do, and we have the challenge of making sure that we're on the programs that fit us best. We're comfortable and probably more comfortable with prototype short runs and that sort of thing. So we're into the missile system. We're into the Orion program. I think that the obstacles on that are going to be the funding, and I'm going to be very interested in the next cycle, election cycle, to see what happens with that. I attended a supplier conference at Lockheed Fort Worth and made a mistake of raising my hand when somebody was there to lobby or anybody in California. And then he just, said, "You guys are nuts. You're not business friendly. He named off all the politicians that he, has to work around and all that. So there's significant obstacles here just because of the cost of doing business in California. I'm starting out early in my career, the chemical mill business. Well, I'm all for the environment, but that was a nasty product to have in California, and it's been encouraged to go elsewhere. And I'm grateful for that. I'm not, not saying I
scoop it out. I don't want to go in that water and see things flow through there. But California has its own unique set of challenges, and outside of that, it's just what programs are there. If that Orion program launches off and they do what they're saying they're going to do, that's great. ULA keeps above board. If SpaceX keeps landing spacecraft backwards, then that's good for me. But we're always one launch failure away from the whole deck being reshuffled. And that's the nature of that portion of the space business. So that's our key is, I think we're going to have to just keep ourselves in place, keep ourselves on the radar with these groups, and then hope for the best as far as certain things that are out of our control at our level.
Yeah, I'm thinking there might be some questions. Okay, so if there are more than just one, if you don't mind, I'll just put the mic down and have it go down, and if you have a question, fine. If not, just send it on.
I'll ask a quick question just so this side feels represented. We have five aerospace companies right now in our portfolio, and one of the places where we always struggle is around the sales and marketing function in these smaller businesses, largely around the talent pool that's available to sell. I don't see the same issue in our other companies at the same size level. I'd be interested to hear your point of view, as you guys are not only in the sales activity but in the procurement of talent piece of it as well. What pools do you find more successful? How well do you think people cross over from other industries who don't have 2 decades, 4 decades of experience? What works and doesn't work in terms of finding talent?
Yeah. All right. I'll take that.
Focus on small to medium-sized business. As when I was doing that, we
tended to have success
looking for somewhat younger, somewhat inexperienced guys
had worked in the manufacturing environment, right? So they didn't necessarily have to know aerospace, but they had to know manufacturing and be comfortable walking around or having seen a machine shop or something like that. And
I just look for high energy and aggressive people. And you can teach them but if they're sincere and motivated and they have seen some manufacturing, most of that sticks. You know, for me, I got a lot of background, and so for guys and gals that had typically competed in sports,
because a lot of times that translates well. You know, if you're great at it, it's okay in high school, I think you're smart at that.
Those are the folks that can take no, that can understand losing, can deal with that type of stuff, and can typically be motivated. So that's where we went. And
if you write your job posting with some of that competitive language, assertiveness, you tend to
find better applicants.
Yeah, I would very much agree with Jason in that regard. The other thing is that, and Ivan and I have had this conversation more than once. You know, unfortunately, as you look at most of the sales leaders are in my era, okay, we have a certain way we were brought up, a certain way we were trained in the industry. We are looking at different generations now coming into the industry with different perspectives and different thinking processes. And what we tend to expect as a sales leader with multiple years of experience is not necessarily the same sheet of music that our recruits are playing on. And so that's why the whole idea of identifying the people with the right makeup and background is critical, but it's also that how we bring them in, what we do to get them to be able to understand our expectations and be successful against those expectations is a big part of it. Because usually when I see it fail, it's not because the person we hired is talented. It's because we didn't do a really good job of getting on the same page in terms of expectations, in terms of results, in terms of performance.
To that, I'm also, especially now with what's going on with Lakers, you wonder who's going to be running the show for them. And so that's what really is.
If you want, in the leadership role, you want someone like Kobe Bryant being the coach, because Kobe's got
raw natural talent,
and he can be a team player
sometimes.
But it's hard for someone like that doesn't have perhaps the way to say, you know, here's how you do what I do. He's going to go out there and say, do what I do.
There are certain people that
I have a question. Generally, our industry is, and it kind of pains me to say this, but we have been reduced to commoditization, and that is that we are focused on cost, we're focused on on-time delivery, and you're focused on quality, and if you don't have all three, you're essentially not in the game. And one of the things that I am finding more and more discussion around is that of lead time and lead time management. And you spoke a little bit about that relative to your roller issues in doing Kanban. Would the other two of you care to elaborate on that?
You can't even talk if you're red with Boeing and red on delivery, red on quality. You're not going to get through. That takes, even if you're yellow in the Boeing system, that has to take a buyer that's willing to do above and beyond their job
to go to their management
and make the case. So
you have to offer something different. Typically, it's price, you know, but it also, and that's what this is all about,
is the relationship
between class and price. If you have a guy that tells you that your price is too high, that's awesome. When that guy calls you and tells you,
price is a little low, you might want to take a look at that. That's where relationships can get you in down the road a little further with what you're trying to accomplish. I'm not sure that answers your question, but basically the call and delivery thing, you got to have that. I spoke about it before in the section. But I think it gets back to relationships. Who you know, who they know is that can help you in the right direction.
There are other divisions for that company. Does he know any of those people?
So,
lean transformation and what we call improvement. So we've gone out and added some staff to really look at what's the continuous improvement plan for us. How do we differentiate based on delivery, shorter lead times? Because everyone's got their day job, really busy. But something emergency comes up and they say, an improvement project, that'll wait. If you have full focus to go around manufacturing department, typically that's helped us. We've seen a lot of ability to differentiate. If we can deliver in 6 weeks, better delivers it in 8 weeks, buyers are going to be impressed by that. So it is unfortunate that it's moving to a commoditization, but if you're able to deliver faster or you're able higher quality, sometimes you can differentiate on those features. So that's what's
and the other part of that is the example I gave of selling a toilet versus selling a whole lamp. I just wiped out a whole bunch of costs. I don't need to necessarily knock my price down.
So it's adding out providing that extra value that takes you away from the commoditization and into whether it's technology innovation,
product innovation, business innovation. From a commodity. It's hard, but when you succeed, it's right up there with a triple and a home run.
I just want to very much support what you just said, and I refer back to Steve Metier when he was head, one of the 8 senior managers of GE Aviation. He spoke at the Orange County Group a couple of years ago, and he addressed this question. What am I looking for in the people we buy from? That's not a trivial company. And he said, delivering on time, having a reasonable price, and having reasonable quantity just gets you in the game. If you don't have that, don't even bother. That's the ticket to get in the game. But that doesn't get you to win the game. And what wins the game from him is what you said earlier, what do you do when we get in trouble? Because it's a 100% chance we're going to get in trouble. Who are you when that happens? Do you pull out the contract, or do you look at it from the customer's side, and how can I help, and what differentiates you? I have 2 other quick comments. One is you spoke about getting in the customer's head, and one of the things you have to be aware of is there's different generations, and they think differently. And it's like, it's the difference between talking to somebody who was brought up in Italy and somebody who was brought up in Australia. I mean, yeah, we're all speaking English, but it is that different. And you sell a millennial differently than you sell a Gen Xer, differently than you sell a boomer. It's just totally different. And the last thing we'll say is shifting, in terms of this mental attitude, if you look at what is sales, and if I ask, now I know if I ask Dave what sales is, I know what kind of answer he's going to get. But for most people, including salespeople, they would say sales is getting the prospect to do something I want them to do. And that's a loser perspective. And if you're coming in with that perspective, you're going to lose. What's a different way of looking at it is sales is serving the customer. You know, it's a conversation in which I got to figure out what's Dave's about, not about me. And if you go into a conversation and it's about you making quota, you'll lose.
I would add one word to your statement. Yes, it's about serving the customer. It's also about educating.
Very good. And that's part of serving.
Yeah.
I am also coming out of the quality field, and part of the
sales process I got involved with was these surveys and just to bid a customer. It used to be, how's your quality? Now it's, do you have an environmental process? Do you have a corporate social responsibility process? Do you have a diversity plan? Do you have an anti-human trafficking plan and, you know, conflict or ethics? So I'm wondering, yeah, conflict minerals. So we're developing products around that using kind of a social media, you know, how fast could you communicate that information? But how much does compliance enter into the sales process these days? And are you hearing more and more about not just quality, but environment and sustainability?
In my current company, it's a client issue that people probably the small business, it kind of works in our favor, some of that compliance. If you are a Eskimo, live in a bad area, and we're in the Army, boy, that's just, you know, that's compliance that works in your favor, obviously. We do only tap into the small business portion of that, so we're not really taking advantage of it. Our processes are not polluting, they're not dangerous. Well, machines always dangerous, but I'm sure that Dave and Jason have way more compliance issues than my company would.
For us, compliance is only challenging the compliance. Once it's in place, just for us, obviously.
Do you see them raising the bar, though, on the jewelers?
They've raised the bar. The bar is set pretty high on a lot of these offerings. And I think that until we have close to universal compliance, we're not going to be jacking the bar up too much.
But it's only challenging that first time. Once you have the process, the system is in place.
You just kind of, is that first time, getting a 14,001 system in place?
Okay.
It's going to take time, it's going to take money, it's going to take work. But once it's in place, you just maintain. The old story that someone once told me, it's kind of like an airplane taking off. The airplane works like crazy to get the altitude. Hard work, lots of fuel, engines straining. But once you're at cruise, you're at cruise.
I would look at this. In some of our businesses, we have, for example, we sell to nuclear facilities. We sell to the military on the F-35. Those areas, the Lockheed and the others. Commercial aspect, for the most part, to compliance. You demonstrate that you can do it, not too bad. And then in our defense businesses, it seems like there's a new requirement every time we have a conversation. And if you just look at the export compliance penalties that very, very serious. Overcompensating.
So that's for us in particular in export compliance, much more.
All the duty commercial.
Yeah. I apologize, guys, but I can 2 minutes.
Yeah, because I got a
four, too. Sure. Irv mentioned different kinds of, we have new employees, different generations. We also, those are also our buyers. I hear they're buying differently. Have you guys leveraged any of the new social tools, social media, blogging, et cetera, successfully to sell to your customers?
We're behind, I think the majority of our buyers and customers are still in the aerospace industry.
Veterans,
some of the new engineers, younger engineers, and my engineers, we're having to do it in a new fashion, so we're going to
go that direction just more slowly probably than
the compliance issue.
Very briefly, because this is you brought it up, Jason. You mentioned training for your salespeople to get them to the next level, sending them to school for a week, etc. I'd love to hear what school is out there that can train people into becoming a good salesperson. You know, I haven't been doing it for 30 years, and learning the, you know, school of hard knocks. I'm just not aware of what's out there. I'd love to hear what you folks have found and share that. Thank you.
I can say if somebody has gone through college and shown that they will stick to it, and that gives you that indication that they're capable of setting a goal, achieving it. But it is hard knocks. I mean, aerospace, there's no aerospace school. Lockheed has a wonderful mentoring system. They have the old dog and the two younger ones falling through the supplier conference. And that mentoring system will be better than anything that they do in that school. It doesn't exist anyway, but it comes down to the core of the person being able to achieve goals and having the fire desire. That shipping guy's a great example. I know you're talking about that. There's a lot more success potential with somebody that you are familiar with. But you can't find it outside of the show, some other kind of drive.
And if you're in school, I would encourage you, literally at local community college, we already set up any kind of stores, one on the stores, one or two. There are just a couple of those classes to give them positions. So you need to reading the materials around the sales. And a lot of stuff we talked about today, Maxwell and Michael Long Riders, it's all consistent in how to work. So if you're doing that at night, and you're learning yourself there during the day, and that was a part of the mentoring, doing the industry language, and doing how we talk to customers. So I still believe that there's a place for formal education, but it's a start. And then we saw it was 20% retention, but I think, okay, this is how I can do my kind of daily sales call, this is how I can structure it. And we've got to walk through some of those examples in class of what's the early road like, right? And then have to sell to the people.
Hold anything, I think, is valuable.
They don't come out of the box. And leadership's role is the mentoring aspect of that. You got to form them into something useful for the music conference.
Okay. In closing, if we'd like to thank our panelists, David Conrad, Jason Childs, and John Chikurian, for coming to us. And we're going to release them.